Welcome to another episode of Facts. I am your host, Stephen Boyce. Today, we're doing a solo episode. My co-host will be joining me again for another episode that we are working on and we're putting together content for on whether or not the church should be seen as autonomous. Did the New Testament teach autonomy? Did church history teach us autonomy? So that'll be an upcoming episode that you should be keeping your eyes open for. But today we're going to be doing an episode on the Gospel of Mark, particularly looking at the alleged claim that there could not have been Peter's eyewitness testimony behind the Gospel of Mark, because after all, he abandoned Jesus after the little campfire incident when he was questioned about his association with him and he took off and left. And therefore, he was not at the time of the final verdict. He was not there at the carrying of the cross. He was not there when he was nailed to the cross. He was not there during the time of his words and seven sayings on the cross. Therefore, he could not have reported from his own eyewitness testimony exactly what took place on the day of his crucifixion. Now, I want to pause here and say that, you know, if we're talking about the Gospel of Mark as a whole, to be fair, at this point, almost all of it is based on Peter's perspective. It is based on Peter's viewpoint, his understanding of Jesus or his misunderstanding of Jesus being put into practice. We see his perspective constantly being carried out in the Gospel of Mark. I did a whole episode on the Gospel of Mark being Peter's gospel. That's back in the archives. If you missed it, please go back and listen to all of those examples where it is Petrine in its viewpoint. But to the fair criticism that we have received about the eyewitness testimony, it comes to passages like this. Well, what about those places where Peter was not there? And those are fair criticisms that we should all consider. But at the end of the day, they're not anything to be worried about, because Peter himself had other associates. He had others that he was working with that were there, people that he knew, people that he mentioned. And in fact, he gives us hints as to where he gets the information from. So let's talk about the potentiality of this just in chapter number 15. Let's bring ourselves to the point where he is now standing in line. He has released himself from the association of Jesus altogether by saying, "I don't know the man." He curses, and then the cock crows three times, and he is gone. He books it out of there. By easy association, we could say that John the Apostle, being a friend of Peter and spent many an hour with him after the resurrection, including seeing him in the book of Acts with Peter, as being perceived also by Paul as one of the pillars, two of the pillars of the three that were in Jerusalem. It's easy to say, well, he got it from John the Apostle. But I would actually argue the fact that he did not receive this information from John. Not that he didn't know John's perspective or didn't have a conversation with John, given that they spent their entire early ministries in Jerusalem preaching and teaching Jesus risen from the dead, like we see in Acts 2 and Acts 3 and Acts 4. I would imagine that they had multiple conversations about the resurrection and the night of his betrayal and all that went on during the time of the crucifixion. But the reason I would dismiss initially that it was John that he had received the information from about the crucifixion and the carrying of the cross and all that followed from that point on is that we see he leaves out two major figures that John includes at the crucifixion story, that being John, the beloved disciple, and Jesus's own mother, Mary. He leaves both out, and I think we're going to come back to why I believe that is significant. Not that it was ignorant or just a dumb mistake that he made on his part, but rather it was intentional to give true credibility to his sources as it relates to the story that we're going to go over. So let's pick it up right at the time where Jesus is sentenced to carry his cross down to his own death. Now, they've made their proclamations and saluted him out of absolute really slander. "Hail, King of the Jews," has been given unto him. They stripped him of his cloak. They took off his clothes. They let him out. He's on his way to be crucified. Now, it states in the text in Mark chapter 15, beginning in verse 21, that there was a man there by the name of Simon. Now, it clarifies, because Simon is such a popular name. You have Simon Peter, obviously. You have Simon the Zealot, also one of the 12. But then he actually gives a distinguishing difference as to which Simon he has in mind. He has Simon the Cyrene. So this individual was apparently at the time of Passover coming to Jerusalem to celebrate from North Africa, because that would have been the region he was in. And it says he was coming in from the country. And the reason for that is they are celebrating the major feast of Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits, which would have been a pilgrimage feast for them to travel at this point in their history. Now, it states explicitly in the other Gospels the same thing, that there is this Simon of Cyrene, this North African leader, who is here in Jerusalem. But what they lack that Mark supplies is that he describes having two sons, Alexander and Rufus. Now, I think it's instrumental that Peter, behind the eyewitness testimony of Mark here, would include them, because he was instructed to help Jesus carry his cross all the way to the place called the place of the skull, or that is Golgotha. Now, when we see this individual introduced who helped Jesus carry his cross, why is it significant, and does it attach to anything of significance, that we would find the two children being listed with Simon the Cyrene? I do. I really do. Now, apparently what was expected at this point is that they would know, the original audience would know, that this is an individual or individuals the church Peter is proclaiming this message to would have already had knowledge of. Now, let's think about that for a minute. The alleged history, and I believe to be accurate, is that the Gospel of Mark was penned by Mark in the city of Rome while Peter was preaching. So Peter's preaching his sermons. Mark is actually collecting those sermons. He is writing a narration of the sermons of Peter being his testimony. And Justin Martyr goes as far as to say, when remembering the words of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, in the Gospel of Mark, he actually calls it the memoirs of Peter. So there is no doubt, and there is actually no debate historically as to who is behind the Gospel of Mark. We have multiple attestations stating that it is Peter. And again, I did a whole episode dedicated to that. Please go back and listen to all the statements from Clement of Alexandria to Papias. Others all make very clear that this is the writings of Peter, or the memoirs of Peter written by Mark. Now, they all state as well, pretty much, that it was in the jurisdiction of Rome. Now, I do think that's where this becomes significant, because if the writer of Mark is Mark and the narrator is Peter, and he wants you to know Simon of Cyrene's connection by including two children of which the church may have been familiar with, what would be the sign that that is not just simply or merely us trying to impose something on the text? Well, could it be that there was a Christian in the city of Rome that Peter would have known to have received the information about the dad, Simon the Cyrene? I think so. I think we can actually give good weight to this from the book of Romans. Yes, that's right. The book of Romans. We have at the very end of the salutations that Paul gives in chapter 16, words from chapter 16, verse 13, and a greeting from Paul to the church there in Rome. Now, remember, Paul has not yet arrived at Rome. He has sent the letter ahead of himself. Peter has already been starting churches and started the Church of Rome. Paul is anxious to meet these Christians that have already been established there. And he has contacts that he is now giving shout outs to in chapter number 16. And one of the individuals he gives a shout out to is in chapter 16, verse 13. He states, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother, who has been a mother to me also." So here in this text of scripture, we have Paul mentioning a person of interest that was known to him and to the church by the name of Rufus. Now, this would correspond cleanly, in my opinion. Now, think about the direction of North Africa. Simon of Cyrene is from North Africa, very close over the waters to Rome, where a lot of individuals in even church history, for example, Tertullian, who is a lawyer from Rome, saw fit to go down to North Africa to defend Christianity in that region. It's not unheard of, and it's actually very known to have a lot of trade and transportation between the North African region and the city of Rome itself. So the idea that Rufus would have been in Jerusalem, or perhaps just his father, and he learned this from his father. Maybe it was Simon and his two sons were there together, which would make sense. Families traveled for this time of year. We see this in the Gospels as well. Even Jesus's own family, when he was 12 years old, given to an account to us by the Gospel of Luke, when they would come to celebrate the pilgrimage feast, Jesus was left behind. The child was left behind. The mom thought the dad had him. The dad thought the mom had him. So, you know, Joseph and Mary ended up booking it back to Jerusalem, finding him teaching there amongst the religious leaders. I mean, it's extraordinary story that only Luke collects for us. But what we find is that families did travel together to these pilgrimage feasts. So perhaps it was Rufus and Alexander who were there to see with their own eyes, or just maybe it was Simon who was able to actually carry the cross, and he continued the rest of his life telling his sons the story. To me, I think it would make sense that family travels, so therefore Rufus and Alexander were there with their dad, and Peter is giving a shout out and a credible footnote, if you would, in his gospel, for people to remember by or to fact check him by giving a name like Rufus, who was obviously in the Church of Rome by the time Paul is writing in the late 50s to the church. So I think it's very beginning stage of the crucifixion narrative we have here. We have Peter. Peter is telling the story. Yes, he is gone at this point, but it seems like he's relying on someone like Rufus, who we know to be in the Church of Rome and probably the same guy, and his mother is probably in Rome with him. No mention of the father, so it's possible Simon is dead at this point. But he's there in the city of Rome, and he is known to the apostles. Why is he getting a shout-out from Paul? Perhaps his reputation and shout-out in the Gospel of Mark has been what makes him connected to an important figure of the apostles in the church. So this section in chapter 15, for example, that we looked at, where the cross carrying takes place, maybe we should accept the fact that the eyewitness help that was given here at the crucifixion began with Rufus. Now, that may have carried because it says they brought him to the place called Golgotha. So he helped carry the cross there. So no doubt the crowd has traveled with Jesus thus far up to this point. So it is very possible that Rufus and Alexander and Simon are standing there at the foot of the cross, beholding this wonder, and the rest of the narration came from the same source that tells us about the cross carrying. I think that's plausible, but I don't think it's only him that's actually supplying this. When we get into the end of the chapter here, we find the death of Jesus, and Mark is explicit, along with Matthew as well, to give us names of individuals and make sure that you see the words "they saw," or "seen," or "beheld," or "looked." You see these terms that are testifying to an idea of eyewitness testimony from the bystanders who are hearing and seeing. So let's get into the later part of chapter 15, verse 33, when they're at 12 o'clock p.m. at the sixth hour. Darkness falls over the whole land. Happens for 3 hours. We get till about 3 o'clock p.m. And in the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." So you have this, my God, why have you forsaken me" statement. Again, Peter's not there to hear this. How would Peter know what Jesus said on the cross? Well, maybe he got it from John, but John himself did not even see fit to include this saying on the cross. So where could Peter have received an information like this? Now, the very next line, I think, actually helps us. And I think it's ironic that it follows the line of Jesus speaking. It says explicitly, the bystanders hearing it said, "Behold, he's calling for Elijah." And some ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come and take him down." And then the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. When the centurion who stood facing him saw that that he was breathing his last, said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Multiple problems here. Peter does not slow down. It's just kind of fact. And we talk about this in the episode I did on the Gospel of Luke, in the Gospel of Matthew, in the Gospel of Mark. When you get into the intrinsic side of the writings, especially Mark, when Peter is on the scene, the elevation of details goes from very, very low to extremely high. It elevates itself to a whole new level. Here we don't see a lot of detail. It's just a lot of matter of fact. This happened, that happened, which does give indication to us based on the rest of the book to this point that absolutely Peter's not here, because that follows consistency to the other events when he is not there. It's very matter of fact, quick to the point, moving on. Just in these section of verses alone, you have multiple statements being made from verse 34 all the way to 39. Jesus makes a statement on the cross. The bystanders hear it and respond with their own statement about Elijah. Then there are those that are standing around, and Jesus in the middle breathing his last. You have a report of the temple. You have the curtain being torn in two from top to bottom. So you not only have a statement of fact, you have a location of the rip. It's from top to bottom. Then you have a statement of a matter of fact of a centurion who stood by facing him, Saul, and said these words, truly this man was the Son of God. So there's a lot happening that Peter was not there for to matter of fact statement about. Now, it could be that he collected this from Rufus or Alexander or Simon, as we've already discussed. Or it could be that he has also received this information from John, who was at the foot of the cross. But he doesn't even mention John being there. So I have a hard time believing he's giving credit to John by leaving him out. Typically, that's the opposite. You leave them out intentionally so that you give credit to those who are there. Now, the centurion's not listed by name, and some have come to say, well, you know, the centurion became converted to Christianity, so it's probably the centurion that told Peter this after his conversion. Well, I don't think that's the case either, because he doesn't even name him, and typically the protocol here would be to actually name the individual who is preceding this and giving you the information. But he does, on the other hand, now bring us into the next section. And the words are important, because up to this point, you hear the word, you see the words here and loud voice, voices. Note the difference from verse 34 to 39, and I'll give the key words to you. Bystanders hearing. Now, it's interesting, it doesn't say they saw. So note the difference of senses that are happening. Hearing said these things. Now it goes into the part where you have the centurion who has stood by facing him. He saw in the same way that he breathed his last breath and goes, truly, this was the Son of God. Then we have another audience who is actually paying attention to the details. And Mark wants us to know that in verse 40, there were also women looking on from a distance. Now note, he goes to name them. He does not name the others at this point. He doesn't name the bystanders. He doesn't name the centurion. He only names the women who were also standing by looking from a little ways off, among whom, and he wants you to know their names so that you can credibility fact check his claim. Mary Magdalene. Mary also known as the mother of James the Younger or James the Less. So you have Mary Magdalene, who had the seven demons cast out of her. You have Mary, the mother of James the Less, who is there. You have also another name. So you have Joseph and you have also James the Less. Then you have another individual that is listed that is not mentioned by name in Matthew or Luke or John. And the reason it's ironic that it's not mentioned by John is because the alleges it is John's mother, Salome. Now, Salome is a Hellenized name of the Hebrew word shalom, peace. Salome is not mentioned anywhere else by name except here and also in the next chapter as being one of the women who is at the tomb. Now, let's just focus on the crucifixion for a minute, because we find three names. And one of the biggest criticisms that there is of the Gospels is that we cannot get on the same page with the names at the tomb and the names at the cross. And if we could just be transparent for a minute, it seems on the surface slightly problematic. But in reality, it's not problematic at all. If you take each individual author as eyewitness testimony and where they are receiving their source material. In this claim, Peter leaves multiple aspects for us to consider with eyewitness thought. We just went over a bunch. Now with the women. The women, he only lists three. We know there's more than that because if you just read Matthew, Luke, and John, you actually get a higher number. You actually don't have very important figures at the cross. One, Mary, the mother of Jesus. How do you forget her? I mean, there's a part of me here that just gets blown away at how easily it would be for an author writer to include Mary, the mother of Jesus. I don't understand it, right? Well, he doesn't mention any of her at the beginning either, the same way that Matthew and that Luke do. Now, let's put ourselves in time and space here for this gospel. We know from the testimony of John that after this event, Jesus said to his mother and to John, "Behold your son, and you behold your mother." So John, behold your mother. Mother, behold your son, John. And it says explicitly by the one that he was actually took her into his home from that day forward. We have statements in history from the early patristics that Mary did actually, in fact, go with John even to Ephesus. So let's put ourselves in a timeline. If the Gospel of Mark was written in the early 50s, which I think it was, if it was written in the early 50s, by this point, after the dispersion, the early dispersion of the Jews, John would have already left, and he would have already made himself possibly to the west, to the east rather than going west. Peter goes west, John seems to go east. Now, in the process of moving forward, if he takes Mary with him to Ephesus, the eyewitness testimony of John and Mary is no longer around Peter. Peter seems to be using mostly his own viewpoint, but where he lacks vision, like these passages, he seems to find those who are still around who are eyewitnesses. Rufus being one of those who was in Rome at the same time that Peter would have been there. Now, Peter was also in Antioch. He went back and forth. We see his travel. In fact, the early part of his ministry, we find Luke progressively putting him in the city of Antioch. Yes, he took trips to Jerusalem at some point. He was there at the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15, but he spent a lot of time, particularly in the city of Antioch in Rome. Now, many had gone to Antioch after the early dispersion, and so in his time at Rome and in his time at Antioch, he could have spent time with the alleged names. One being Mary Magdalene. He could have spent time with her, maybe a very important figure to consider on that. It is also very possible that he spent time with James the Less's mother, who he lists there, or specifically James the Less himself. So it's possible that the fact that he mentions the, once again, children, note that, children. You have Simon the Cyrene and his two children, Alexander and Rufus, who are known. Then you have two children listed with the name Mary, the mother of James the Less, and also the information of Joseph. Now, there's a whole lot of debate about who that is, but let's just focus on James the Less and the fact that in two circumstances, we have two names of two children associated with somebody significant. Here's what I think. I think his information came from twofold. Number one, from James the Less. The children seem to be the ones reporting to what took place. And it could be that James the Less actually informed Peter on what his mother had instructed him, or that Peter actually received the information from Mary herself. I think that there's another eyewitness here that's important. And I think it's very important because he brings this woman up twice, and that's the woman Salome. Now, let's talk about Salome for a minute because there's a lot of dispute about who she is. There's two Salomes, and they should not be confused in the Gospels. There's one who was a part of having John the Baptist killed. That is not the same Salome who is presented here in Mark 15 and Mark 16. But let's discuss this woman and her role at the crucifixion. Let's read the words again that we have here in the text. There are also women looking on from afar off, among whom Mary Magdalene, the mother, and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Salome, who was also with him and ministered to him when he was in Galilee, and many other women who followed him to Jerusalem. So you have this extra section here where you have the women being listed, and there's a description here after Salome is brought up. It says, when he was in Galilee, they followed him and ministered to him, and there were many other women. Why doesn't Peter or Mark care to inform us of these others? They recommended the idea that others were there, but why do they not state names? Again, silencing the names of those who are not contributing to giving name and credibility to those who are was a common practice that we see in the Gospels, very much so in the Gospel of Luke, especially on the two disciples on the road of Emmaus. You find when you are in the road of Emmaus story, Cleopas is mentioned, the other is silenced. I'm sorry, does that mean that nobody had a clue as to what was going on here? Does that mean that somebody didn't know the other guy as the disciple on the road of Emmaus? His name just slipped Luke's mind? Or was Luke giving credibility to the one who actually probably gave him the actual information? I think it goes back to the information. He's getting the information from Cleopas, giving credibility to him by silencing the name of the other and giving information from the one he does name. And I think that Peter's actually doing the same thing here along with Mark. And it goes on, and it's interesting. It states that these women were there ministering to him from the time he was in Galilee. Now, in the parallel passage over in Matthew 27, verse 56, it reads this way. Many which was Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, which we just connected those, and the mother of Zebedee's children. Now, this is where interesting connections start coming into play. The belief system has concluded at times that the mother of Zebedee's children, James and John, which would be two significant apostles, that it was Salome that was their mother. Now, in John, there are no mentioning of his mom being there. The only mom mentioning we have is that Jesus says that Mary is now the mother for him, and he is now the son for her. But he doesn't even mention, if Salome's his mother, he doesn't even mention her in the gospel account that he has. It says, Jesus's mother and his mother's sisters, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, which is, again, connected back to Luke's account that I just mentioned, same Cleophas who was one of the disciples on the road of Emmaus. And then John mentions Mary Magdalene. So you have Mary, the mother of Jesus. You have Mary's sister being mentioned, which is the wife of Cleopas. And then you have Mary Magdalene. And so some have identified Salome as the sister of Jesus's mother, making Jesus cousins in this whole realm. Now, again, I don't think this is something that can be argued for strength of evidence. I think that when you start putting two and two together, you can make that claim, but we have other places where it does not seem to work. So this woman, Salome, is significant. Now, what if she is the mother of James and John? We have another set of brothers here. Matthew mentioned Zebedee's mom was there. Whether that is Salome or another woman will actually leave us a little bit in question as about who is who. There's so many Marys, it makes it confusing. But that's probably why Peter in the Gospel of Mark said, and there are some other women there too, right? Just trying to take the burden off of listing all the lists of Marys with their descriptions. But we do find that Salome is there in his account, but not by name in any of the others. And some have supposed that Mark and Matthew are actually mentioning the same woman. It's just that Mark gives her the name And rather, Matthew gives the description as Zebedee's wife being there. So if that's the case, Matthew may have silenced Salome's name and only mentioned his description because he's letting you know he didn't get this information from her. Whereas Matthew would give credit to Mary Magdalene or to others. But Peter, trying to give credibility to Salome, would actually mention her name, not just a description. So what do I think? What do I think? Well, I am not dogmatic on any approach of this. I think it's possible that Salome is the Matthew woman described as being the wife of Zebedee, the mother of those two children, James and John. And if they are the same, and Matthew knows what Mark put there, chooses to change name to description, Matthew would silence the name for the purpose of credibility, letting you know, I did not receive this information from this woman, but wanted to follow Mark's list. Because look at the list. I mean, they're pretty close, actually, in order as well. In Mark's gospel, you have Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and Salome, who followed him. Matthew patterning a similar scenario here is, to me, what's interesting. Mary Magdalene, same order. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, same order and same children and spelling. And the mother of Zebedee's children. So if Matthew is following Mark here, and he would need to, because again, Matthew wasn't there either, and he's sourcing this to the credibility and maybe even confirmed it with some of these women, it's interesting he would mention two that Mark mentioned, but silence the third one, where Mark does not. So it could be that Matthew was patterning himself after Mark because he clearly was using Mark's gospel. And after patterning it with Mark, he maybe reaffirms this with some of the women, but cannot reaffirm it with Salome, either because she wasn't there or she was already dead by this point. But at any rate, he decides to silence name, put description there as a result in order to maintain consistency with Mark, but give credit where credit is due, where Mark was trying to give credit where his credit was due. And then Salome shows up at the tomb as well. Now, in the Gospel of Mark, Salome is among the women who's at the tomb, and it helps try to anoint the body of Jesus with the spices. And it states this, "And when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome had brought sweet spices that they may come and anoint him." That's chapter 16, verse 1. Now, they discovered the tomb had been rolled away, and that was open. The stone was rolled away. They're coming in. They go, "Oh, my goodness, body's missing." A young man dressed in white told them Jesus had risen, and then they were to go to the disciples and tell them in Galilee. They left completely astonished, and we have the whole narrative seeming to actually wrap itself up on these women leaving frantically after the report. That's all we know. That's all we know of Salome. Now, she is mentioned quite a bit outside of the New Testament. In fact, she's in heretical works as well. The Gospel of Thomas actually describes her among the disciples of Jesus, a Methetes. Now, it does not appear that she is called these descriptions in the synoptics, just that she was a supporter and a follower, which would make sense if she actually is the mother of James and John, and she is married to Zebedee. Zebedee had servants, so he had a little bit of wealth in his fishing business. And another thing that would bring some interest in mind here too is that if it is the mother of John who is also at the cross, you think about how he got access into the courtyard and into the trial of Jesus. It says that he was known to the family in connection through the high priest. Let's back up. If this is John's mother, and if there's a connection to the high priest with their family, and this mother is actually related somehow to the family of Jesus, Jesus had a family relationship with John the Baptist, where Mary and Elizabeth were distant cousins, and we know Elizabeth's husband was involved in the high priest. And if John is actually somehow family related to this family group of John the Baptist and with Jesus, and there's some sort of distant family relations in here. If John the Baptist's father, exactly as the New Testament describes for us, is a part of the Levitical priesthood, there would be family connection for John to have gotten himself into that trial period that also got Peter in as well. And it would make sense that there's a connection there. And it would also make sense as to why John would have been one of the early disciples of John the Baptist. So John the Apostle, remember the anonymous disciple in John 1 with Andrew, is already a disciple of John the Baptist before Jesus. Now, I don't want to dive into this too deeply. Maybe we'll do another episode on it. But just I'm putting out there ideas to consider that maybe this all does actually connect after all. But here we have this woman who is connected by the funding, perhaps, of even Jesus' ministry, as described in Mark's gospel and in potentially even Matthew's. But she is mentioned by name in the Gospel of Thomas. So the Gospel of Thomas would have been utilizing Mark. Now, I've demonstrated in the Gospel of Thomas that he uses all four of our canonical Gospels, so he would have been post any of them, borrowing their material and manipulating and twisting quite a bit, I may add. But it does mention Salome and Mary. It doesn't say Mary Magdalene, just explicitly states Mary. The name could have been Mary Magdalene. But it mentions within there that she is one of the women that was a disciple to Jesus. So she is mentioned in extra biblical literature, including heretical ones like that. In the Diatessaron, which is a very early writing that particularly focuses in on some of the things that you see in the Gospels, we have a statement in chapter 52, verses 21 through 23, reads this way. And there was in a distance all the acquaintances of Jesus standing. And the women that came by from him from Galilee, those that followed him and ministered. One of them was Mary Magdalene. Here it is. Mary, the mother of James, the younger, and Joseph. That's consistent with Matthew and Mark. And the mother of the sons of Zebedee and Salome, and many other which came up unto Jerusalem. So note that the Diatessaron actually separates Salome from the mother of James and John. This is why I say it's not so easy as just to say, oh, yeah, well, then they were all connected. They're all family. That's the end of the story. Actually, it's not that simple. I wish it was. Because now we have testimony where they're actually distinct and not the same. There's also in the controversial work known as the Gospel of Mark that is secret, the secret Gospel of Mark, so to speak, and it's only mentioned by Clement of Alexandria. We also see information about this woman, Salome. It actually says, a quote actually comes from Clement that says this, then he came to Jericho and the sister of the young man whom Jesus loved was there with his mother and Salome, but Jesus would not receive them. So this is interesting. Again, Salome is now brought up in what's called the secret gospel of Mark. And by the way, at some point we will do an episode on that. It is on my long list of episode ideas. We will get into that, but nonetheless, she is mentioned there as well. There's also another gospel, it's a heretical gospel called the Gospel of the Egyptians. It is anywhere from 2nd to 3rd century. Now, Salome appears again in this book, again as a disciple, similar to the Gospel of Thomas. She asks him how long death would hold sway. And he says to her, so long as the woman brings forth, for I come to an end of the works of the female. Now, again, this is Gnostic terminology. There's so much hidden packed stuff in there. But then Salome ends up replying in the passage, then I have done well in not bringing forth. So in this gospel, it appears that Salome was barren. So she can't be the mother of Mary or the mother of James and John, the son of Zebedee. Not a chance because she's barren and she's going along with this prophecy, so to speak. But again, it is mentioned, she is mentioned as a significant character as it relates to connected ministry with Jesus. She was significant. Why is she significant? She's insignificant in any other passage. Then we have other places in early writings and Christian texts that mention Salome. A Salome shows up in the infancy gospel attached to James the Just. called the Proto-Evangelion of James. She's mentioned in there as well. Here's the reading. And the midwife went out from the cave, and Salome met her. And the midwife said to her, Salome, Salome, I will tell you a most surprising thing which I saw. A virgin is brought forth, which is the very contrary to nature. To which Salome replied, as the Lord my God lives, unless I receive particular proof of this matter, I will not believe that a virgin is brought forth. And Salome went in, and the midwife said, Mary, show yourself, a great controversy has arisen about you. Salome tested her with her finger, but her hand was withered, and she groaned bitterly and said, woe to me because of my iniquity, for I have tempted the living God, and my hand is ready to drop off. So Salome apparently was an individual in this, again, another heretical gospel narrative, another testimony that's not accurate, in my opinion. These are not reliable sources in any way, shape, or form. They're more folk legend. But here's Salome, who actually tests, because she didn't believe in the virgin birth. She didn't believe Jesus was actually a virgin born. She tests Mary. And in testing Mary, her hand actually withers. It's kind of a disgusting thing to think about, but that's what's happening in the passage here. So again, one of the things that we find in the passage, and again, sorry for the camera that went out, folks. We'll continue to just listen to the audio here. But one of the things that continues on in the passage is that when we find Salome here, Salome actually is an important figure outside of the whole entire recollection. She's outside of the entire eyewitness testimony. She's mentioned by Gnostic Gospels. She's mentioned by early church Gospels. And again, sorry for those that are on YouTube. I'm not sure what happened to the view here, and that's fine. Just carry on with the audio. I'll post something up here. I think I can get myself back on shortly. There. I'll have to try a different camera. How about that? Those that are listening on the audio podcast, congratulations. This isn't a problem for you. But think about this for a minute. When you go through these passages, Salome is very important to everybody else in addition to Peter. What I believe about that is this. Salome is an important figure giving the information to Peter. Others later also know Salome. Others are also involved with Salome. Others see her as important enough to validate the virgin birth in a narrative like the Proto-Evangelium of James, which I find to be ironic. Then you find that she's also even in probably one of the more popular Gnostic Gospels, which are like, in my opinion, one of the early forms with the Sayings Gospel of Thomas. She's mentioned even in a Sayings Gospel to validate this. So ironically enough, I leave my statements at this point. I believe that the burial side of things, the view of statements from the centurion, what took place at the temple, because you have connection to high priestly connections there, as we've already seen in John's gospel, that Salome is actually a major person connected to Peter getting his information of Jesus on the cross, along with Rufus, Alexander, and possibly even Simon himself, and that within Simon and within Rufus and Alexander, they're known in Rome. Peter could have received this information, testifying on the behalf of Salome, using her by name. Matthew leaves her out anonymous and inserts only a description, or leaves her out completely, depending on if you believe Salome is the mother of James and John, the wife of Zebedee. Now, the Diatessaron being early actually separates them. That is the only one that causes me to pause. Really, it's the only one that causes me to pause. And in my pause, I actually disagree with the Diatessaron. I actually do think that Salome is the individual mentioned in Matthew as the mother, because I think he's following the same order as Mark, and he purposely silences her there. Now, I know that Mark mentions other women were there, and it's very, very possible that in mentioning the other women that are there, he purposely deviates off the conversation. All that to say, I don't think that disregards the argument that can be made that she truly was connected to John, or she was connected to Jesus, even in a distant family relationship, and that Peter had this conversation with her, had spent many hours with her. And there we find Mary, the mother of Jesus, not even mentioned. And John's not even mentioned, because when Mark and Matthew are written from Rome and Antioch and or Jerusalem, I believe Matthew would have been published from both. And so being a headquarters gospel, John is in the East. John is over here in Ephesus. John would not have been able to actually give the full embraced identity there of the testimony until it was his time to put a gospel together. And that's what happens. The gospel of John actually mentions that he is there and mentions that Mary, the mother of Jesus, is there. I don't think that Peter forgot that. I don't think Peter didn't know that. I don't think Matthew didn't know that. I think they intentionally are giving you the testimony or validation of testimony from the women they had the actual conversations with to give claim and credibility to. That's what's happening here. And so the broad argument ends on this. Does Peter have to be at these events to tell you what happened? Does Mark have to be properly giving us the discussion that he finds within the narratives and within the sermons of Peter to validate? No. No. I don't think he does, because if he knows multiple people who can validate it for him, that is sufficient. And now let's think about this. He's a Jew. And by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word should be established. In each event, he gives you three names with the addition of others. He gives you Simon and his two sons, Alexander, Rufus. In the cross narrative, he gives you three explicit names that he wants you to know. He wants you to know Mary Magdalene. He wants you to know Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. He wants you to know Salome. You have the establishment of two or three witnesses being listed in there, and then the rest are just other women, or just a centurion, or bystanders who were there, not listing any names. So even in following Jewish law to make a position and defense, we find all of this consistent with the practice of telling a narrative and having credibility behind it. So yes, I do believe. I do believe that the eyewitness testimony of Peter is sustained through the entire book up to this point. He did depend on other witnesses that he was able to collaborate with. I think the big shout out here is Salome and Rufus and Alexander and Simon the Cyrene. And I think we can validate through the book of Romans. I think we can see other biblical sources that are actually pointing to this happening. I think we can see why Matthew silenced Salome's name and gave a description. I do think it's the same woman. I don't have a problem if it's not her. If there are two separate women, as the Diatessaron demonstrates for us, fine. That's fine. If they're not the same, I'm good with all of it. Good with all of it. The fact is, we have multiple eyewitness testimonies and attestation beyond just the apostles themselves teaching and testifying what Jesus had done. We see this in the early writings of the church too. Even Eusebius reporting multiple men who testified around the time of Trajan, who living, breathing miracles were still existing at their time. People raised from the dead, people are healed of major disease, were still alive on the planet telling what happened. It wasn't just 12 men giving testimony to the resurrection of Jesus and all that was done. We need to lose that mentality. It's not the way the gospels were given to us. And as I stated before, many of the gospels, I believe three of them, are group gospels. I don't think Mark is technically a group gospel. It's primarily Peter, but it is in places like this where he had to collaborate and work with others to get the information that was needed. And he cites them and he gives them credibility where they deserve it and lists them by name and silences the others who are not there at all. All right. Well, thanks again for you who tuned into this episode. Sorry for the camera fallout. I had to switch cameras here. Didn't even realize what was going on. But again, to those that are on the podcast, thanks for tuning in as well. Make sure you like and subscribe if you have yet to follow our channel on either your favorite platform, being Spotify or Apple, Podbean. And I find out there's more and more as we go. We have 7 platforms of podcasting. We also are, in the last 3-4 months, working ourselves into YouTube. And that is those of you that are on the live stream now. Thanks for tuning in here. Make sure you hit that like and subscribe button. If you have not done that yet, we would much appreciate that. We are going to be more active on these. In fact, we will have moving forward and put this down. We'll make an announcement on Facebook, which is also new. We'll also be putting out a new website here very soon. And those of you who have been asking about being Patreons and stuff, we are also working on that with the entirety of the new whole makeover that we're giving it, with a website and everything. That will be a part of that. So thanks for those. I've had dozens reach out and ask where they could start contributing, and I appreciate that. I'm sorry I had to put you on hold, but we want to do it the right way. We want it to be able to be something you can write off in your giving. So stay tuned as we continue to do all that. We will also have a merchandise store. Some of you may have seen my coffee mug that I carry around, or my Yeti with my facts emblem and statement on it. We will have merchandise, shirts, things like that, hats. We'll have that available because many, many of you have asked for that. So we have heard your cry, and we desire to do that. It'll be fun. It'll be exciting. Tyler's looking forward to that too. So keep your eyes and ears open. As we continue to grow this thing, we're going to have a lot of special guests coming on soon. I want you to stay tuned for those. We're going to have a lot of special guests. So we're going to have everything from science. We're going to have everything in. I'm going to have Wesley Huffman to talk about a new manuscript that seems to have some sayings in it, including the Gospel of Thomas with the gospel accounts that we have. So we'll be bringing him in. Jonathan McClatchy will be coming on. He has a doctorate in biology. He's in the area there. We're going to talk about intelligent design. We'll have an episode there. We'll also have Eric Ybarra coming back on to talk about the Last Supper and Melchizedek from his book. He will be on as well. We'll also have priest Pat May on. We'll be on very soon. He and I will be doing one on, is the priesthood even necessary for church? Why do we use that terminology? Where does it come from? If we're in the priesthood of believers, we don't need priests, right? So there'll be an episode on that coming up. Folks, I have multiple episodes being lined up for our show. And then in addition to that, those will be like Monday, Tuesdays most of the time, maybe a few Saturdays. But in addition to that, Tyler West and I will also be doing our own podcast weekly. And that weekly podcast from now on will be live streamed on Saturdays at 2:00 Eastern Standard Time. So that means if you're listening to this on Spotify or listening to this, on one of the Podbean or Apple, you will probably see these released every single week around 3 to 3:30. On those platforms, give or take, 30 minutes to an hour as they release, because they take a little bit of time to show up after uploading them from the live stream here. But on YouTube, we will release them at 2:00 live stream every week. This will be our new time, new space, so you can come into and be a part of and in the chat. Thanks to those in the chat that were going in. Thanks, SlamRN, again, for pointing out the camera part there. The rest of you, I trust that tomorrow, being Easter Sunday, will just absolutely blow your minds and hearts, just blow it away, and then draw you close to God. I am excited. I love Holy Week. I love this time of year. This is the time of celebration. Today is Holy Saturday, as we commemorate and think about darkness and despair and confusion. But don't worry. Don't worry. Tomorrow is the celebration of light and life, resurrection and beauty, and defeat of our enemy, and victorious life in our Savior. So good, so good. Well, that's all I have for you today, folks. Thanks again for tuning into this episode. May God bless you, keep you in His care. Grace and peace.